Welcome to Community Roundtable. I'm Bev Alquist, and with me today are Natalie Warren and Scott Kavarik. And they're here to talk about a new EPA rule that protects wetland areas in Minnesota. And Scott, tell me about that new rule.
Yes, thank you. This rule was issued by the Army Corps of Engineers and EPA late this summer, and it's designed really to restore long-standing historic protections of the Clean Water Act to small streams and wetlands all across the country. And these are protections that were in place from the time the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972 till about 2001, when the Supreme Court first issued a decision that began to, for lack of a better pun, muddy the waters about which types of waters, streams, ponds, lakes, the Clean Water Act protects. And the Supreme Court, in its rulings later on, another case in 2006, really called on the agencies to clarify the definition of the waters that are protected, and that's just what this rule is designed to do, clarify which waters are covered by the Clean Water Act and which waters aren't.
So what waters does this all include?
So it basically restores protections that it applied for decades to tributary streams, streams that flow into larger waters that then cross state lines, for example, to wetlands adjacent to those waters, to large water bodies that affect, interstate commerce, drinking water supplies. And it also, for the very first time, clearly identifies waters that aren't covered by the Clean Water Act, from things like ornamental waters in people's backyards to many roadside ditches and to gullies and, erosional features on the landscape.
Okay. And what is your title again, and how are you involved in this?
Yes, I'm the executive director of the Isaac Walton League of America, which is a national conservation organization. We have about 1,400 members in Minnesota and about 43,000 members nationwide. The organization was founded in 1922 by fishermen, by hunters, by outdoor recreationists who were first and foremost concerned about the impacts of water pollution and wetland drainage on natural resources that they enjoyed. And we've been involved in this particular issue really since the Clean Water, since the founding of the organization, and in this particular issue since the early 2000s, when the Supreme Court began issuing a series of decisions that really caused a great amount of confusion and uncertainty about the waters that the Clean Water Act protected. And we've been fighting since then to restore these protections, and this rule from the Army Corps and the EPA does just that.
Now, I understand that Senators Franken and Klobuchar voted against both bills to protect Minnesota's water resources.
No, in fact, it's just the contrary. There were bills in the Senate a couple weeks ago that were designed not only to roll back this rule, but to prevent the Army Corps and the EPA from ever issuing any other protections like it. And they both voted against those bills. They voted with sportsmen, with countless Minnesotans like Natalie, who enjoy water-based recreation, canoeing and kayaking throughout the state, to keep these protections in place, as well as protect drinking water for about 1 million Minnesotans who get their drinking water from public systems that are fed by the very small streams that are most at risk under, that have been most at risk and are now going to be protected again under the Clean Water Rule.
I must have misunderstood that, so they did vote for the bills.
No, they voted against the bills, which is a vote for clean water, because those bills would have rolled back the rule.
Okay, I had the opportunity to talk to our senators out in D.C. in October, and they were both very for clean water and supportive of our headwater state.
Hey, that's great to hear. And Natalie, tell us about yourself.
I am a paddler and a Minnesota environmentalist. I was one of the first two women to recreate Eric Severide's route from the book Canoeing with the Cree. So I paddled from Minneapolis to Hudson Bay on the Minnesota River, Red River, Lake Winnipeg, and the Hayes River out to York Factory. And it was on that trip that I really interacted with communities along the river, with farmers along the river, and got to learn how complex our river systems are, and also experience a lot of water pollution. When we were in Lake Winnipeg, we were actually paddling through really thick green algae and algal blooms from a lot of the nitrogen coming off the farm fields on the Red River. And I currently do work on the St. Croix River, working on local policies to preserve and protect the water quality.
Okay. And I understand that you took a group of students, or you do, teenagers, on the Minnesota River?
Mm-hmm. Yep. So the Minnesota River has been a big focus of mine. Before I paddled the Minnesota River, I was told that it was the river of chocolate milk and people just don't paddle there. And what I found was a really gorgeous river that, yes, has impaired waters, but is aesthetically beautiful, has a lot of state parks and wildlife areas. And I wanted to protect that and share it with other people. So I started taking youth out to paddle on the Minnesota River and do things like stay with farmers and tour wastewater treatment plants and learn how to fish so that people in the Minnesota area, in the Twin Cities area especially, can start utilizing that source for recreation, for hunting, for fishing, which right now I think is underutilized, and that's really dependent on the water quality.
Yeah, clean water is very, very important. How does it have an impact on fishing?
Well, when you have over 1.5 million people in Minnesota with their fishing licenses, and if you have murky water, if you have water that is the wrong temperature for the right fish migration, or you have dams in the way, there are a lot of things that fish are very sensitive to. And when you put pollutants into the water, you'll see a direct effect between the fish that you're trying to catch and the water quality.
Like, how many days do people fish over a year?
I couldn't tell you how many days they fish. But I have worked with the New Ulm Area Sport Fishermen Group, and I know they have a steady membership out on the Minnesota River, and they're out fishing all the time.
I could, Bev, I could add something to that. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service every 5 years does a comprehensive national survey of anglers, hunters, and wildlife watchers. And in their most recent survey, Natalie mentioned 1.5 million anglers in Minnesota who spend an average of 14 days fishing per angler, and more than almost 22 million days fishing. So that gives a sense of, you know, just how much. And as you know, I think so well, and Natalie can speak to this too, I mean, outdoor recreation, water-based outdoor recreation in Minnesota is big business. Anglers alone spend about $2.4 billion annually on equipment, on trips in Minnesota, and broader outdoor recreation in Minnesota when you include fishing and angling and paddle sports and hiking and camping, the whole panoply, $11.6 billion in annual consumer spending supporting about 118,000 jobs. And that's analysis done by the Outdoor Industry Association, which represents largely companies that make outdoor recreation products, and they annually produce information about the economic value of outdoor recreation.
Great. And some of the work that I've been doing is working with small towns to revitalize their communities based around the river. A lot of towns, and especially western Minnesota, are agricultural towns, and with the advancement in technology have been seeing decreasing populations, and they're starting to worry about, you know, keeping young people in the community and figuring out another industry that could really revitalize them and study their populations. And that, I believe, is focusing on the river and really pushing paddle sports tourism, because 50% of Minnesotans own a boat, and if you can really try to get those people into your community for just a quick weekend getaway, then I think we could start seeing a big difference in the local economies that have agriculture but also have paddle sports tourism.
That's very important. Can you also talk about the hunting impact? Yeah, either one of you?
Yeah, sure. I mean, when you think about, you know, similarly in terms of expenditures for, you know, hunters, I mean, and of course this is across, you know, not as water-based as angling, but, you know, there's about, again, this is Fish and Wildlife Service information, it's about 477,000 hunters in Minnesota. Again, big economic impact, about $725 million in annual expenditures. And here's the one thing that I think is so relevant to this particular issue, and this is, again, from the Fish and Wildlife Service. They ask, you know, they break the hunters down into different categories, right, in terms of big game, small game, you know, and folks who hunt migratory birds, which doesn't just include ducks. It includes some upland birds, but it's largely duck hunters. And duck hunters in Minnesota spend more than twice as much per hunting trip as all other hunters in the state. So when you think about, again, the economic impact, right, duck hunters, to the point that, you know, Natalie mentioned of people making trips and so forth and so on, you know, are spending significantly more than someone who squirrel hunts or, you know, hunts deer. And, of course, wetland habitat is absolutely critical to healthy duck populations. That's where ducks are born, and that's where they're raised successfully, whether that be, you know, from the prairie pothole region right there in the upper Midwest, all throughout this country. And ducks that are reared there in the prairie pothole region are shot here in the United States.
Wow. Can you also comment on, like, public drinking water supplies?
Yes, I mean, that's another one of the issues here. You know, you've got a lot of focus on outdoor recreation, but, you know, there's a public health aspect here. Several years ago, the EPA did a comprehensive assessment of public water supply systems that are fed, you know, in whole or in part by the small streams that are most at risk of losing protections. And what they found was 1 in 3 Americans got the drinking water they use at home from one of these public systems that's fed by these small streams. And in Minnesota, the estimate was about, I think I've got the figure here, was about 978,000 Minnesotans get their drinking water from these systems. So, and again, it's not hard to think about. If you've got clean water coming into these sources, you're going to have cleaner drinking water, and it's going to require less effort and less expense to treat that water before it goes to your home. If you've got that water coming in that's impaired, that's polluted because those streams aren't protected by the Clean Water Act, right, then your source water isn't going to be as clean as it needs to be. Your local water utility is going to have to spend more in order to clean it to get it to your home. You know, forget about your exposure to these waters when you're out recreating or your pets or whatever the case may be that don't have the benefit of the water going through the treatment plant before it comes out of the tap.
What are some of the other issues that are involved?
Well, I think, you know, these are,
water.
Yeah, these are fundamentally, you know, when you look at outdoor recreation, when you look at public health, I think when you look at the economy more broadly, there's been a number of craft brewing companies, frankly, that have been very actively engaged in this issue because for them, clean water is absolutely essential to the product they make, and, you know, their economic success. So that's, you know, another example here of, you know, what's important. And I think just, you know, fundamentally, you know, it's for me, it's hard to think about, you know, an issue that's more important to all of us than clean water. We all depend on it, right, whether it be for drinking, for the economy, you know, frankly, you know, if you know, in agriculture, in a wet state like Minnesota, you may not have to rely much, you know, on irrigation. But in many other parts of the country, irrigation is absolutely essential to successful agriculture, and those producers want access to clean water. You know, they don't want to be accessing the water that, you know, Natalie described, you know, the chocolate milk type scenario. So it's fundamentally important for so many aspects of our lives and our economy. And I think, you know, fundamentally what we've got here is the EPA and the Army Corps taking common sense steps to restore long-standing protections of the Clean Water Act to waters in our communities that are important to all of us.
And another thing I would add to that, is we experience a lot of flooding, especially on the Minnesota River, and by restoring these wetlands or protecting the headwater stream, then that will decrease the destruction of the flooding that we've seen in the past couple of years.
That's a great point.
Do you want to kind of explain that a little more?
Yeah, so currently for the Minnesota River, for example, there is more water than there ever has been in the river basin because the water is rushing straight to the river, and that's eroding the banks, and so we have a large sediment issue. And if there were backwater streams where the water could store and the sediment settle and then will come back to the river eventually, then we'll have less water surging to the Mississippi River than we would if we just had farmland or we just had concrete in the cities along the river. We need a place for that water to go and to recharge the groundwater, especially during the flood state.
Can you also talk about how to clean up polluted water?
Well, nature is trying to do that. We just have to let it. I mean, there are many, Scott mentioned that there would be consequences if we didn't clean up the water because we'd have to spend lots of money to go through another filtration system, for example, like they're currently doing in Des Moines, Iowa. But nature will filter the water if we just plant, if we put buffer zones along the river and if we protect the headwater streams, then it will make a huge difference in the water quality. And that's something that's low cost and it's at the beginning of the issue.
And of course it'll take time.
Absolutely. It will take time, but rivers are very resilient.
And protecting what we've got, you know, like conserving the natural wetlands we have now, you know, is the most cost-effective way to reduce, like Natalie was talking about, reduce flooding, right, to filter pollutants from the water before it gets to larger waters, before it gets to our drinking supply. I mean, by just, you know, keeping those in place, we've taken the most important step to safeguard probably our most important natural resource.
What other comments would you like to make on this important subject?
Well, the only other comment I would like to make is, you know, the fact is that you know, there's still, you know, critical threats, you know, from Washington. The Congress is considering, as we speak, and likely to vote next week, on, you know, another year-end catch-all government funding bill. And there's ongoing efforts to use that legislation to roll back the Clean Water Rule. Senators Klobuchar and Franken have stood with sportsmen to oppose that type of legislation. You know, and the thing we're all concerned about, you know, is what's going to play out in the Congress over the next couple of weeks, where the threats to our water remain, you know, very serious. You know, our organization and many others are working hard ensure that doesn't happen. But that's going to be, you know, critical decisions to be made in Congress over the next couple of weeks that directly affect the water for every American.
Now, will you be going to Washington to lobby for this?
I was there in October, and I had the opportunity to lobby in support of the Clean Water Rule. And Scott is already out there.
Okay. What else would you like to tell me? And Natalie, you're, co-founder of Wild River Academy?
Yes. So my experience paddling from Minneapolis to Hudson Bay was the inception of a nonprofit organization on the Minnesota River watershed, but also nationwide. We do canoe expeditions and try to engage communities and participants in water quality and issues surrounding watersheds.
And you're also the first vice president of the Minnesota Valley chapter of the Isaac Walton League?
Oh, I don't know if I'm the first vice president, but I'm the vice president of the Isaac Walton League in the Minnesota Valley chapter, yes.
Okay, and Scott, you are executive director, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, the Isaac Walton League is very well known around the area, around the state.
Yeah.
Does a lot of good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much. We've got great members throughout the state, you know, very committed who are working hard on a lot of issues. And, you know, the organization traces its roots to the upper Midwest, to Illinois and Minnesota. You know, the founders of the organization knew the Mississippi, the backwaters of the Mississippi, intimately. And what they saw happening in the 1920s, you know, really spurred them to action, to not only, you know, work individually, but collectively and found our organization. And I think probably, you know, water-related issues have been the most important issue for the organization since its founding, and that remains true today.
Okay. Is there anything else the public should know about?
There is a way to get involved if people are looking to get involved locally. The Minnesota River Congress, people can attend meetings and express their concerns about water quality in their area, and there are also several Isaac Walton League chapters. Ours in the Minnesota River Valley, that's based in Bloomington, and then there's a big chapter in New Ulm as well.
Okay. Well, I thank you both for speaking with me this morning.
Thank
you. Thanks for having us.